You know, as with all other Hebrew Bible prophets, it is the so-called Old Testament prophets, Malachi speaks not only to the wayward Hebrews of his era, but rather to the people of all eras. And I think as I look around at the place and trajectory of world events and history in our day and time, his words have urgent and most pertinent meaning for us all, if only we'll hear them. Now, among the themes of Malachi, the one that grabs my attention above all the others is the failure of the Hebrew religious leadership to know truth and to speak truth. The priesthood is the primary target of Malachi's disputations. They had grown lax yet again. They had adopted paganized doctrines to teach and practice instead of God's recorded word yet again. And were leading the people towards yet another catastrophe, unless a significant repentance and change of direction happened. How very applicable his words are to the modern state of both Judaism and Christianity. Now, I say modern state advisably, because for a long period of time, some of the great believing theological thinkers who had the courage to do so have been warning and attempting to expose not only what is called Christendom for what it actually is, but also for what its beginning really was. And few have paid attention. And more often these men have been marginalized, left in the shadows, so as not to disrupt huge and complex religious systems put in place long ago, designed more to bring about the agendas of men than the will of God. Now, one of these great thinkers is Soren Kierkegaard, who has greatly bothered the church for nearly two centuries. Even so, he has been heavily quoted, often misquoted, and his many works utilized by Christian theological institutions since the mid-1800s, so profound are some of his thoughts. And yet, they have also been cherry-picked to avoid the things he said that they did not like or that frankly condemned these same theologians or church governments for their perversions of biblical truth. Now, to summarize who this man was and to best explain what academic disciplines were his specialties, which of course combined to greatly affect his view, I want to use the secular Wikipedia so as to avoid religious, denominational, and doctrinal contamination. So here is a quote from their expose on him. They say, Kierkegaard's theological work focuses on Christian ethics, the institution of the church, the differences between purely objective proofs of Christianity, the infinite qualitative distinction between man and God, and the individual subjective relationship to the God-man Jesus Christ, which came through faith. Much of his work deals with Christian love. He was extremely critical of the doctrine and practice of Christianity as a state-controlled religion, Caesar Papism, like the Church of Denmark, and his psychological work explored the emotions and feelings of individuals when faced with life choices, unlike Jean-Paul Sartre and the atheistic existentialism paradigm, Kierkegaard focused on Christian existentialism. Now, Before I quote Kierkegaard himself, let me explain an important term used in Wikipedia's brief exposé. Existentialism is a family of philosophical views and inquiry that explore the human individual's struggle to lead on a to lead an authentic life. Despite the apparent randomness and chaos and incomprehensibility of our existence as humans that we experience in the real world. So existentialism examines meaning, purpose, and value. Where our thoughts about these things come from? How we decide which to adopt, what roles they play in our actual daily lives. Thus, here's what Kierkegaard concluded about Christianity, the institution, as a competing source of meaning and purpose for living an authentic life. And again, I'm bringing this before you because this is essentially the foundational reasons for Malachi's disputations and criticisms of the priesthood of his era, which are meant for Bible readers to understand as expanding in scope over time to include all the official religious institutions that purport to represent the God of the Bible and his son, Yeshua of Nazareth. Now, I urge you, please, give all your focus to just these few sentences. He says, Christendom is an effort of the human race to go back to walking on all fours, to get rid of Christianity, to do it knavishly under the pretext that it is Christianity, claiming that it is Christianity perfected. The Christianity of Christendom takes away from Christianity the offense, the paradox, etc., and instead of that introduces probability, the plainly comprehensible. That is, it transforms Christianity into something entirely different from what it is in the New Testament, yea, and to exactly the opposite. This is the Christianity of Christendom, of us men. In the Christianity of Christendom, the cross has become something like a child's hobby horse and trumpet. Now, I imagine you got the sense of this. But due to the era this was written and the high vocabulary of academia used at that time, let me assist a bit in explaining what's being said. Here, Kierkegaard first speaks of the brand of Christianity that our church institutions teach and practice. He means it in the sense of a supposed Christianity that is not the authentic Christianity that Christ taught. Christendom is the general label he uses to call the combined, vast Christian church network composed of many institutions that had spread around the world. And some of these were state religions, whereby the king was both head of state and head of church. Now, I regularly use the term Constantinian church to more or less refer to the same thing he does when he says Christendom. So to him, Christendom is the state institutional religion begun during Constantine's era, when he too declared this new religion for Gentiles to be the state religion of the Roman Empire. And this religion's government to be defined and controlled by the Bishop of Rome in collaboration with the Roman Emperor. Now, using Kierkegaard's labels, then, the idea is that Christendom claims to teach the authentic faith of Christ, but in fact they do not. It is so far away from authentic that he says it's nearly the opposite. And it turns the cross into some childish toy to be made into whatever seems pleasurable. Now, to reduce this quotation down to its basic essence, it is that when looked at not so much microscopically, but rather simply on the basis of what all can see and hear are the actual practices of the church, its teachings and its effects, what the church, Christendom, espouses and teaches and demands of its adherents is the virtual opposite of the faith that Christ lived and taught. And I can tell you that many great theologians and believing thinkers long before Kierkegaard, well after him, have been saying the same thing, but to little avail. The church has become so powerful and headstrong that it merely bats away all objective criticisms and continues its path of indoctrination of popular but unsound religion, even if its core principle of faith in Jesus is true and solid. So just as in the Old Testament Bible era, when the Hebrew faith leaders time and again would stray from the truth and institute instead their man-made traditions and agendas, and when God would respond by sending prophets with warnings to them to return to the true faith, so during the last 1,500 years or so, a number of men of courage attempted to bring various reform movements to Christendom. Sometimes this resulted in the creation of new denominations. But generally speaking, as these newer denominations grew in numbers, if they survived at all, the leadership soon succumbed to the illness that inherently affects all humans. That is, our hearts are sick, wicked beyond self-repair. So church leadership of these reformed churches devised ambitious agendas outside of God's will that again began to override God's recorded truth. In the 1960s and 70s, the Jesus movement arose, and it was a good thing that brought countless thousands to the cause of Christ and also caused many church leaders to repair and reform their agendas, to re-include the nearly lost components of evangelism and biblical authenticity. Of course, as typical, a few new denominations arose from this newest reform, and over the next 40 years, most of them also succumbed to human agendas, and consequently, their effectiveness has all but vanished. In the 2000s, a new movement has sprung up that goes by various names, including the name Seed of Abraham chooses, which is Hebrew roots. And so I begin today's introduction to our study of the prophet Malachi with a warning to us all who call ourselves Hebrew roots, Jewish roots, Messianic. Listen very carefully to Malachi's message. What God began as something good can be quickly tarnished by human hands. Malachi's message was not against the institution of a priesthood as originally ordained by the Father, but rather against what it had become. And the negative outcomes always, I stress, always begin by men. Leadership straying slowly. then at a quickening pace, step by step away from the strict truths and commands of the Bible, only to be replaced by subjective thoughts of those men who think they have been divinely inspired by new truths, new commands that modifies or replaces the older and original ones. The reality is that new truths that replace the older and original biblical truths is an oxymoron. The new truths are not truth at all. So with that premise in mind, let me set the historical background for our study. There is no consensus that a person named Malachi wrote this book. Malachi in Hebrew means my messenger, or possibly my angel. And even the word Malachi itself is what's called an apocopated form. And before you scurry off to a dictionary, all that apocopated means is that it's a shortened form of a word or a phrase that usually is constructed by just dropping the ending of that word or phrase. It's a common literary and grammar technique used in most languages. For instance, the common word photo is but an apocopated form of the word photograph. So the longer form of Malachi is Malchiah, which means messenger of God, perhaps messenger of Yahweh. This has resulted in some Bible scholars thinking that this indicates that Malachi is not a proper name of a prophet, but rather the book's title is actually meant to be messenger of Yahweh, which includes no one's name. In fact, today, the preponderance of commentators no longer believe that Malachi is the proper name of a particular prophet who wrote this book. Rather, the author is anonymous, much the same as with the New Testament book of Hebrews. Now, the Greek Septuagint that was created in the 3rd century BC, which is but a Greek language translation of the Hebrew Bible, translated Malachi as by the hand of his messenger. Rashi and later Judaism, as well as Jerome and Calvin in church history, say that Malachi is not the author's personal name. These sources believe that Malachi is simply a title for Ezra, the scribe. That is the same Ezra that is the author of his own book. Okay, there is no other person in the Bible named Malachi. So there is good reason to suspect that this was not a person's proper name. That said, even later Jewish tradition seemed to eventually swing back the other direction to decide that even though his name was unique, still Malachi was the proper name of the prophet who wrote this book. Some of the biggest names in modern Christian scholarship have done the same. Now, I'm taking the position from my own research that Malachi is indeed the formal name of a specific prophet, admitting that this cannot be taken with certainty. Although he would certainly be unique among prophets, because no book of biblical prophecy has been handed down through the ages from an anonymous author. Either way, this doesn't demean or cast doubt on the authenticity or spiritually inspired nature of the book. Now, although Malachi is far more straightforward prose and less reliant on symbolism as compared to the book we just concluded, Zechariah, which is mostly poetry and symbolism, nonetheless, because the book is so ancient and based on a very unique Hebrew culture and written in an ancient nounless form of Hebrew, then the many early translations of it in different languages have translated the Hebrew text with some differences among them. Therefore, when arriving at an accurate English text for the 21st century, it is best to look at all these various older texts, taking something of value from each to arrive at the most probable and originally intended interpretation. Now, in addition to us having the book of a book in Hebrew that is based upon the Masoretic text of about 1000 AD, we also have fragments, a few fragments, of Malachi from the Dead Sea Scrolls. But they are so limited and incomplete that not enough can be drawn from them to be helpful, other than to confirm that for certain that the book was originally written in Hebrew and that it had to have happened well before the Qumran Dead Sea Scroll sect came to be. And further, that the book Order of the Minor Prophets, as we have it today, was the same in the ancient pre-Christ time. So, in addition to the ancient Hebrew texts of Malachi, there are also very old Greek, Syriac, Aramaic, and Latin versions. Now, interestingly, the Latin, also known as the Vulgate, and the Masoretic Hebrew texts match so closely that they offer a good witness of their accuracy. Therefore, other than for the typical unintended copyist errors that are normal and natural for handwritten copies of the Bible in the pre-printing press era, what we have today from Malachi is quite good and reliable. That said, we must always factor in, especially as concerns the scores of English translation Bibles that are offered, is the denomination and ideological mindsets of the publishers. They each have agendas that can and do cause translations to be bent to uphold their particular doctrines, traditions, and preconceived notions. And we're going to do our best to filter those out. Now, Malachi is one of the 12 books of the so-called Minor Prophets. In fact, it is the final book of the 12, and Malachi is considered as the last Old Testament prophet. I'm going to remind you, the term minor was not meant to denote lesser value or importance compared to the major prophets, but rather referred only to the book's shorter length. The person Malachi was a Jew who returned from Babylon under the leadership of Zerubbabel, according to the Jewish Talmud. He, along with Haggai and Zechariah, are called Second Temple prophets because of their association with the reconstruction of the temple in Jerusalem and the restoration of the Hebrew faith in the land of Judah, which at that time was a province of Persia called Yehud. Now, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are often seen as sort of a trilogy. And very likely, the authors of these books not only knew of one another, but possibly collaborated to some small level. Now, dating Malachi is a bit dicey, because the only historical event mentioned in it that can be reasonably dated is the destruction of Edom. But even that's problematic because there were a couple of different destructions of Edom. The first in the 6th century BC that happened at the hand of Babylon. The second and more complete destruction was by the Nabataean Arabs that came later in the 5th century. So the closest thing to a consensus for dating Malachi is that the prophet prophesied somewhere in between Ezra and Nehemiah, that is between 458, 445 BC. Now, some do argue for an earlier date, around 500 BC. Others think that Malachi prophesied after Nehemiah, which would place him around 435 BC. I don't find it particularly critical which of those dates might be the most precise. Malachi's message remains true, and it remains the same regardless where within that time frame it was written. That said, I see Malachi as having more resemblance to the concerns of Nehemiah than of Ezra. We find Malachi and Nehemiah both speaking about the problem of general wrongs within the Jewish society of the returning exiles, as well as the corruption of the newly reinstituted priesthood. And apparently, due to the influence of 7 decades in Babylon, intermarriage between Jews and other ethnicities had also begun to run rampant, which of course naturally introduced the problem of bringing pagan, non-biblical morals and ethics and God worship into these newly formed families. Now, because the Persian emperors had agreed to help financially with the rebuilding of the temple complex and parts of the city of Jerusalem, and because there was no tithing occurring during the 70-year exile period, the paying of tithes to the priesthood by the returned Jews had not revived. And because of the exile and the relatively new return, observing Sabbath properly had also become an afterthought. Nehemiah and Malachi both addressed these issues as well. Now, I've stated on numerous occasions that the lives of the Israelites were not lived in a bubble. They were part of a multicultural, interconnected, and vibrant world. They knew their neighbors, and their neighbors knew them, and there was much communication and interaction. And especially as concerns the broader Middle East and Mesopotamia, what happened to one nation usually had an effect upon others in the region. And since nations are nothing but collections of individuals, then world events, of course, helped shape the background, the context, the thoughts, and decisions of everyday Israelites, as well as those of their prophets, priests, and civil leaders. See, there were national moods then, as of now, as like now. People could feel confident about the future, or pessimistic. And all of this and more shaped conversations, what concerned people day by day. It even had an effect on their vocabulary. Now, the most dominant background for Malachi was the Persian Empire, because the place the Jews now lived, the former Judah, was but a backwater Persian province named Yehud. And Yehud provided Persia with only a single significant reason for the king and emperor to pay any attention to them at all. Geographically, it was the land bridge between their much more important province of Egypt to the south, which connected it to the rest of the empire to the north and east. Therefore, despite the often stated teachings that somehow King Cyrus, Darius, and later kings of Persia showed great deference to Yehud by sending money to rebuild their temple, even appointing a Jew to be their governor, this is simply not so. Providing these funds and encouragement were merely standard Persian governing policies carried out throughout their empire. In reality, they paid little attention to Yehud because the place just didn't matter much to them. It brought them no wealth or resources of any kind, nor was it highly populated, such that it provided soldiers for their army, things which were always the higher priority for conquerors. All they wanted in Yehud was for peace, calm, loyalty to the king of Persia. Now, very likely either Xerxes or Artaxerxes was in power when Malachi wrote, or perhaps he even wrote under the transition of the one to the next. Darius, who came before Xerxes, had died around 485 BC at age 64. And Darius spent the greater part of his reign in this power struggle with both the Greeks and the Egyptians. And this matters because it affected Yehud and his Jewish residents. You see, was this constant warring all around them? The prophetically foretold shaking of the nations that would lead to Jewish independence. I mean, what was the people of Yehud to think when the Persians were surprisingly trounced in battle by the Greeks at Marathon? And depending on the earlier or the later date, the one accepts is when Malachi wrote, I think was the later date following Nehemiah, then we have these wars and battles of the Persians and the rise of the Greeks, the rebellions of Egypt, that did not lead to what they thought and hoped it would: freedom and a restoration of Judah as a sovereign nation under a Davidic king. See, this meant to most Jews that Haggai's prophecies had failed. Their living conditions were not only not improving, if anything, they had deteriorated. Crop yields had not risen. More diaspora Jews were not pouring back home. Their economic circumstances had not improved. And while their present governor was a Jew, he was not from the line of David. The favor that they had expected from Persia, their change of fortune, had not come about. So how were they going to accept Malachi's divine messages from God? So see, this is the milieu into which Malachi's prophecies were delivered. Now, when the approximately 50,000 Jews returned home from Babylon following their 70 years of exile, it had been to a much diminished province, which consisted of only around half the territory of their former Judah that they had left. See, this was during Haggai's prophesying period. They encountered a mixed population of mostly non-Jews with a high percentage of Samaritans that opposed them, resented their presence. There was but minimal economic activity occurring because, as God had promised, when his people weren't in the land would not prosper. So the returnees experienced a long period of economic hardship, something Haggai said would change. By Malachi's time, it had not. At least it had not for the better. And even more, the Persian kings heavily taxed them. And the overlord of the Persian satrapy, in which they were part, called Eber-Nahara, levied his own heavy tax upon them in addition. So what Ezekiel and Haggai seemed to promise, the return of a Davidic king to rule over a prosperous Judah, hadn't come about by that time that Malachi brought his latest word to the people. Okay, ask yourselves, what happens when a state or a territory goes through seemingly never-ending poverty conditions and you have lost all confidence and hope for positive change? You seek who to blame. So who failed the people more? The prophets? Their Jewish governor? The priesthood? God? See, in Malachi's time, it was the Levitical priesthood that held the most local power over their lives and fortunes because the high priest had been given new and more authority by the Persians that went beyond his former authority granted by God that was primarily over the religious institution of the temple. The high priest of Yehud held more sway than the civil governor. And no doubt this had something to do with Malachi's message being aimed squarely, or at least mostly, at the priesthood. In the end, those Jews who still held on to their faith in Ezekiel's and Haggai's prophecies now believed that the predictions were for an undetermined future time. That is, the expected apocalyptic day of Yehovah was delayed. Therefore, so was the arrival of a Davidic king, delayed. The result is doubt, uncertainty, of course, and it brought on the greatest disappointment. On another front, we must remember that Israelites' previous prophets, for the most part, delivered their messages to certain people or to an Israelite king. And beginning with Haggai, then Zechariah, finally Malachi, this changed. Now the emphasis was directed to the Jewish people in general and the priesthood specifically. Why the priesthood? Because as we just discussed, the priesthood had a position of more political and religious and social power at this time than the primary civil leader, the governor of the province. And God found the priesthood to be more than lacking. They had perverted their God-given roles and become corrupt. They suddenly found themselves in God's crosshairs, at least according to Malachi's message. Now, we've just come from studying a prophetic book, Zechariah, that had the greatest mention in the New Testament of any Old Testament prophet. Malachi falls at the other end of the scale. There is no mention of Malachi. That said, there are a number of quotes or paraphrases from Malachi's book and some pretty obvious allusions to the words and thoughts used by Malachi. For example, in Romans 9:13, we read, "Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated." In Malachi 1, verses 2 and 3, we read, "Yet I loved Jacob, but Esau I hated." Then there are allusions that are likely to have come from Malachi, at least in spirit, such as in Luke 6:46, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and refuse to do what I say?" In Malachi 1:6, we read, "A son honors his father, a servant his master. If I'm a master, where's the respect due to me?" There are at least a dozen other statements in the New Testament that fall within that range. So despite not hearing his name, we can hear the echoes of Malachi in the New Testament, even if sometimes they're a bit faint. Now, in Judaism, there are actually standard occasions when Malachi is read in synagogue services. For instance, in the Torah portion cycle, when reading Genesis 25:19 through 28:9, it is read with Malachi 1:1 through 2:6 as the Haftarah. Another is the reading of Malachi 3, verses 4 through 24 as the Haftarah, when read together with the Torah portion assigned for the Sabbath that occurs at the time of Passover. Now, for those who might not know, tradition has divided the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, into 54 parashot, or portions, read in order, with one read every weekly Sabbath, beginning with just Genesis. And a supplement to that Torah reading is what is called the Haftarah, which are excerpts from various prophets, both major and minor. Now, it's especially interesting to me that on the Sabbath that is nearest to Passover, when Malachi is read, we encounter 3:22, which reads, "Remember the Torah of Moses, my servant, which I enjoined on him at Horeb, laws and rulings for all Israel." So this injunction, found late in the book of Matthew, was there for the reason that the failure to read the Torah and to teach the Torah fell squarely upon the Levite priesthood. And I mentioned earlier in our introduction that the themes of Malachi that stand out, what grabs my attention, is the severe chastisement of the priesthood for their laxity, for directing the people in tradition, in doctrine, rather than in God's word. It is with sadness and trepidation that the words of Kierkegaard come flooding out of their pages in regard to the leadership failures of Christendom that have turned it into something unrecognizable as a biblical faith that claims it gets its marching orders from Jesus. Kierkegaard's thoughts can be directly associated to Malachi's 3:22 injunction to read and follow the ways of the Torah as given on Mount Horeb. I mean, do you remember his stinging words that I spoke to you just minutes ago? The Christianity of Christendom transforms Christianity into something entirely different from what it is in the New Testament, yea, into exactly the opposite. Now, if the shoe was on the other foot, and Malachi had spoken Kierkegaard's words in his day, he would have said something like, the Hebrew faith of the Levite priesthood transforms the Hebrew faith into something entirely different from what is in the Torah and the prophets, yea, into exactly the opposite. Kierkegaard's statement and Malachi's message echo the same sentiment and warning to God's people. The priesthood in general didn't listen. Neither has Constantinian Christianity. It is critical that the Hebrew roots and messianic communities, and especially our leadership, don't find ourselves deserving of the same accusation because we neglect obeying the word of God and instead embrace and highlight traditions and customs in their place. Now, Malachi's little book is but 3 chapters long. Some Bibles divide it up to make it 4. And perhaps it's just brevity and straightforward statements that make it a bit easier to read and understand. Yet, just like the other 11 minor prophets, longer or shorter doesn't matter if we don't look at them carefully. Study them in their Hebrew context and take their words to heart. I mean, we are blessed in that we have the record of hindsight, something that most Jews didn't have in ancient times, to realize the accuracy of the prophets' admonitions and predictions. I mean, finally, by our day, so much of what the ancient prophets prophesied has come true. Historians have recorded it. And now, remaining redemption history has set itself into motion for the few remaining prophecies to come about, likely sooner than later. There's much contained within the book that leads us to imply that almost certainly Malachi was a priest, probably a lesser priest. At least that's my personal conclusion. Now, that's not a new conclusion. It can be traced back to early Judaism among some of the sages who suspect this, as do I, for no other reason than he seems intimately familiar with the failings of the priesthood and so knowledgeable of the covenant. Something that the average Israelite in his era would have known little of. After all, the only access people in his era had to the Holy Scriptures was whatever the priest determined to orally teach them. So the people had no means to fact check the priests, no way to hold them accountable, which is so unlike believers in our time can do because God's word is readily available. Yes, these words of Malachi are God's message, but they came from the mouth and hand of a human being. Thus, The human perspective always gets intertwined in prophecies to some degree. Now, one profound thing that God has taught me in my nearly eight decades of life is that I can speak of something better and more authentically to others if I have first experienced it myself. I can speak of sin because I have sinned. I can speak of redemption because I've been redeemed. I can speak of loss and failure because I've experienced both. I can speak as a lay person in a congregation because I've been one. And I can speak as a faith leader and a Bible teacher because God has allowed me to have that experience as well. In Malachi's words, my life experience makes me sense his personal acceptance of the failures of his own assigned duties as a priest. Likely sometime earlier in his life, maybe not all that much earlier because he seemed to have been a prophet, but for a very short time. He seems to understand that he was made a prophet for a single purpose, to relay a very focused message from the Father. But now, as a prophet and as a former priest, he has the opportunity to speak from life knowledge and experience, the authentic truth that God has shown him as one who was culpable and recognizes it. Malachi speaks from a covenant perspective. His moral stance is objective, based on the law of Moses. His message is primarily one of rebuke and condemnation, rather typical for prophets, for disobeying the covenant. The moral and spiritual condition of the returned exiles and their religious leadership are nearly identical to that of our Christian institutions of our day. So just as I am regularly characterized by many Christians as nothing but a church basher, so was Malachi looked upon as little more than a Judaism basher by the religious leadership and the bulk of the common public. Therefore, some listened to him, but the majority did not. And yet, despite the strong words of divine rebuke, the first words of God's message to Israel through Malachi were, "I love you." And in the 21st century, that message and truth still applies to the gone astray Christianity and to every strain and segment of believers' faith in the God of Israel and his son, Yeshua, no matter what we might call ourselves. Next week, we'll begin chapter 1.